The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you today. And we have a debut novel for you. Molly Prentice wrote it. It's called Tuesday Nights in 1980. It's set in 1980 in Manhattan, New York, as the burgeoning art scene is underway. And this is quite a debut from Molly Prentice. And she has an experimental style of writing, and we'll be talking to her about that. But first, let's check in with the folks at National Public Radio, and then we'll bring you the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Molly Prentice. She joins us by telephone from Brooklyn. Hello, Molly.
Hi, Vic. How are you?
Excellent. Well, Molly, it's a Tuesday afternoon in 2016, and you have a new book out called Tuesday Nights in 1980, and I'm thinking, was she even born in 1980?
That is the first question everybody asks me. No, I was not. I was born in 1984, so 4 years after the set of my book.
What connects you so much with this period? What is it about this period that you find so intriguing?
Well, it's sort of a long, funny-ish story how I got to start writing about this period. I actually didn't set out to write a book about the 80s. It wasn't necessarily... I wasn't necessarily honing in on that time period from the start. I was working a lot with these characters who sort of led me to that time period by way of their connections and their relatives. So I initially started out this book writing about a young boy who had freshly moved to New York and in present-day New York. And I really wanted to write about that that feeling of just getting to New York, because I had recently done that myself and it so impacted my life. But then I started, as I often do, kind of going on offshoots with that character's siblings or parents or uncles, and I ended up writing about that character's uncle, who was this painter from Argentina who had come to New York earlier than the younger character had. So that kind of set us back in the time period of late 70s, early 80s, when that character, who eventually became Raul, who's one of the stars of this book, he came to New York in that moment. And as soon as I started kind of researching the art scene and the feeling of New York during that time, I was sort of hooked, and I ended up really wanting to stay with Raul in that time in New York. And so, yeah, I landed there sort of circuitously. I didn't set out to write this book about that time. But once I was there, I wanted to stay.
And is this your first book?
This is my first book, yes.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
The book is Tuesday Nights in 1980. Molly Prentice wrote it. And based on everything I've heard, I don't know this for a fact, but I think if you moved to New York City in 1979, it was a lot more affordable than if you moved there today.
Yes, it was. I think actually that was that's sort of one of the reasons why I was so attracted to this time, especially to the creative atmosphere of this time, because as someone who has a creative profession and being friends with a lot of people who are artists and writers and sort of creative thinkers, and living in New York now, I think it's a very different world and different scenario, especially economically. And I think that really lessens the opportunity for sort of creative collision and space, alternative spaces, and kind of ways in which artists can exist in sort of off-kilter or different ways in the city. I think it's much harder to do that now. And I think that as me and my partner, who's a visual artist, we've kind of been seeking ways that we can kind of make our lives as artists in the city, and it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. So I was, once I was writing about that time, I just, I don't know, it sort of gave me this feeling of excitement and possibility that is kind of hard to get now here.
When I think of that period, the late 70s and early 80s in New York City, even though I wasn't there, I picture a lot of things. I picture disco music. I picture Studio 54, a lot of art, a lot of underground art. Keith Haring in the subway painting really fast, really wild stuff. The onset of the AIDS crisis. Lots of artists who died young, like Keith Haring, like Jean Michel, who, and they both make cameos in your story.
Yes, they do. Yeah, I think exactly what you're describing is sort of what I dug up. And I mean, you know, I wasn't there either, obviously, but I just, when you hear the stories and when you read about that time, and even when you look at pictures of that time, you can just sort of feel that kind of crackling energy of, and you're right, a lot of them did die young. And then all these sort of like, you know, the commercialization of the art world and the AIDS crisis and all these things started sort of to come down on that scene. So it was sort of this, I'm interested in that moment that was sort of right at the front end of that, where there was this sense of sort of anything was possible. And just that kind of energetic feeling that was happening in art right then.
Oh, and one more thing I think of is punk. CBGBs, all those all those punk bands. Molly Prentice joins us. Her book is Tuesday Nights in 1980. I don't want to do any spoilers.
it's so hard with this book, though, isn't it?
Yeah, let's lead our listeners into this. Tell them what you want them to know about the story.
About the book.
Yeah.
So this book is it's what they call a braided narrative. So it's three perspectives. That sort of each have their own airtime and their own chapters in the beginning of the book, so you get to know them separately. And then these stories kind of come together and weave together throughout the book. And the three main protagonists, although you do hear from some others throughout the book, but the three main people are James Bennett, who is an art critic for the New York Times. And he is special because he has this condition called synesthesia, which basically it's a neurological condition where the synapses in your brain or the wires in your brain that have to do with senses are crossed or swapped. So you might always see the color red when you smell a certain smell, or you might, when you see a certain word, you might hear a sound. So these people actually... their brain produces sort of dual senses at the same time. So he has this condition which enables him to look at and feel and experience art differently than almost anyone else. And so he translates this condition into really kind of nuanced and fresh writing about art. So people are sort of getting excited about him in the art scene because he can really speak to art in this new way. In sort of a magical way. So he's one of our guys. And then the next protagonist is Raul Engales, who I mentioned earlier. He is a painter from Argentina, and he leaves Argentina in 1976, which is just on the cusp of the dirty war in Argentina, which is basically when there was a military coup and the military took charge in Argentina and kicked out the president and started trying to eradicate the country of quote-unquote radicals. So they were basically cleansing the country of anyone they thought could have any radical thoughts. So this really meant artists, writers, intellectuals, a lot of young people, and they were capturing these people and keeping them in sort of underground jails under the city of Buenos Aires and all throughout Argentina. So Raul gets out just in the nick of time from that situation, and he comes to New York with the idea of becoming sort of a famous artist. So I can't spoil anything by talking about him anymore, because each of these characters sort of undergoes these massive sort of tragedies that end up changing their whole New York life and their life in general. But I'll get to Lucy. So Lucy is the third character, who is a young, she's 21 when she comes to New York, and she's this really sort of beautiful and seemingly innocent young woman coming from Ketchum, Idaho. And she comes to the city with sort of big dreams. She really wants to be a part of the scene. She wants to meet the artists. And she ends up falling in love with Raul Angales and sort of acting as his muse at the front end of the book. So those are the three characters. And then everything else that I could say might be a spoiler at this point.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm talking to Molly Prentice about her debut novel, Tuesday Nights in 1980. And my favorite character in the book is the future art critic, James Bennett, who has synesthesia. And as a special treat this morning, I'm going to read you a little introduction to show you how he comes into the story and how he's different. This is called Seven Steps to Synesthesia. 1. Mother, Orange. James was born different, or at least that's what they called it, the doctors and the nurses, when he came out floppy and smaller than average on November 17, 1946, in a low-ceilinged hospital in Scranton, Pennsylvania, on a morning marked only by an ambivalent drizzle. A certain anxiety had been bred into him. He screamed more than any other baby in the maternity ward, as if he already had something to say. His parents, a shifty banker, James Sr., who slept with his eyes open, and a lazy housewife, Sandy Bennett, formerly Sandy Woods, who hailed from the South, loved pina coladas, and specialized in making her son feel as different as they said he was, and not in a good way, misunderstood him from the start. His early childhood characteristics, seriousness, tenacity, anxiety surrounding food, a squeaky yet sincere laugh, made it so everyone else did too. He didn't talk until age 4, and when he did, it was in full existential sentences. "How old are we when we die?" was the first question he asked his mother, who swatted at him with a peach-colored fly swatter, looking at him incredulously, and said, "Are you blankin' kidding me?" "No," James said, already computing his next question in his mind, which was, "Why was I born?" James was shorter than average, large-eared, eager to be at the center of a playgroup, quick to ditch the playgroup to study something more interesting than other humans, a caterpillar, a melting ice cube, a book. When he was 8 years old, he discovered his secret powers. He caught his finger in a screen door and yelled the word, "Mother!" And he distinctly smelled oranges. His mother was busy painting her toenails the same pink as her pillbox. And so he sat on the front steps of his house all afternoon saying, "Mother, mother, mother," and breathing in deeply through his nose in between, awaiting the flash aroma of citrus. 2. Beige, Doom. Soon after came the realization that his secret powers, the smells he smelled, the colors he saw, were not normal. This realization came to him not as a sudden surprise, but rather as a slow, steady amassing of minor incidents that made him feel crazy. Georgie called him a dumbass when he answered a math question with the word beige. Miss Moose, his overly optimistic third-grade teacher, made notes on the margins of his homework that said things like, "Inventive, but still incorrect." His mother began forcing him to drink a chalky powder that she mixed into glasses of water, which the pediatrician had told her would keep her son regular. At the young age of 10, James sensed that he was Not regular, even a little bit. Not even at all. Parents and teachers saw James's condition as an oddity or a lie. He was pegged with having a vivid imagination or a tendency toward exaggeration, and was twice made to see school psychologists because of something he wrote in a paper or said in class. "Your boy says he is seeing colors," he overheard a teacher tell his parents when they picked him up one day. "And today he said he felt fireworks behind his eyes." Was it a problem with his vision? Was he seeking attention? Whatever it was, Mr. and Mrs. Bennett were not pleased about it. "No more of this crap," his father had said on the car ride home. James just looked out the window, away from the angry gray of his father's words. He would get a spanking tonight, he knew. A series of very hard spankings, probably, but he couldn't help what he had felt that day in class. The numbers had made him feel sick. The way Miss Ryder had colored them had been all wrong. Nines were blue. Tens were dark blue. And she had assigned them pinks and reds. Miss Ryder, his father, all the booger-nosed kids in his classes, everyone, including him, knew that he was doomed. And that is our introduction to my favorite character in the new novel by Molly Prentice called Tuesday Nights in 1980. We'll continue our conversation with Molly right after this. This is the Book Nook on WYSO. Today, my guest is Molly Prentice, and her book is Tuesday Nights in 1980. Well, I think I'll tiptoe through this little garden and talk about some of these characters and some of the things that I got out of it. And And one thing was that Raoul is the tortured artist. He's the epitome of the tortured artist, and the things that you put him through are really indicative of just how much he has to suffer. And the one thing that he can't stand is for anybody to need him. He has tremendous guilt, doesn't he?
He does. He has massive guilt.
That's not a spoiler, is it?
No. I mean, I could speak to that a bit. So when he leaves Argentina, he leaves his older sister behind. And so he and his older sister were orphaned at a fairly young age when they were teenagers. So, when he leaves Franca, his sister, in Buenos Aires to come and pursue his dream as an artist, he sort of does it with a closed door. He slams the door in her face, basically, and doesn't reach out to her again. But he does. He harbors this massive guilt about that. And I think in a lot of ways that sort of drives his need to create and make artwork and sort of that darkness within him that will always be there.
Molly Prentice joins us on the program today. Her debut novel just came out. It's called Tuesday Nights in 1980. I loved this character, James Bennett, and we get to see him grow up and mature. And as we're watching this, we're thinking, how is this nerd ever going to find anybody to be his partner? And yet he miraculously finds this woman, and man, she is a rock.
Yeah. Marge is a rock for sure.
She's the glue, as you call her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She's the glue.
She holds it together, and he's so out there because he has this condition that you described. This is a condition where when he sees somebody, he gets this impression. He gets a particular color impression or a scent impression. He looks at his future wife, and he gets the same impression every time, and it's very vivid for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Is this a common condition?
I think it's more common than people might realize. I don't know the numbers exactly, but not a lot of people know about it, but I guess a fair amount of people have it, and a lot of people have it in really subtle ways, so it's not necessarily always so dramatic as James is. James has an especially dramatic case where he basically has a lot of connections that his brain makes, so almost all of his senses are triggered by his synesthesia, whereas a lot of people will have just really subtle forms of it. So, like, a woman wrote me an email the other day, and she was talking about how she had this sort of spatial synesthesia, where when she imagined the numbers, they always formed like a circle around her body. Mm. So basically she saw the numbers in space, and she could physically see them. So she called it. She was like, I know this is the most boring form of synesthesia. And I was like, no, I think that's fascinating. But there are all these ways in which it can transpire, and it's really different for everyone. And one of the really interesting things I think about it is that the connections in your mind are fixed. So if you see the number 5 as red, you will always see it that way if you have that sort of synesthesia. It's not like new colors and sounds and things will sort of appear for you regarding different. The connections are fixed and static, almost like just like how if we would see something as someone without synesthesia, we would always see it as the color black or, you know. So it's a really real and physical phenomenon for these people and doesn't feel sort of like imaginary or magical.
Molly, I'm curious about your style, because as I read the book, I said to myself, well, she's really doing some different things here. You have such an intense way of writing, and you have some techniques that were completely new to me. Tell us what your approach was here with the writing style.
That's really cool to hear. I appreciate that. I think that style in writing is really important to me, and it's something that I really pay attention to. And I think that when I think that I've been influenced a lot by sort of a lot of experimental pieces of writing and poetry and, shorter flash fiction that has a lot more to do with just the words that you choose, specific words that you choose, and the way sentences sound, and sort of like rhythmic writing. And so since I began writing, I mean, or maybe since I was little, actually, like I've always had a big interest in words and how they sound, and sort of like using rhymes and puns and alliterations with language. I think all those things have always been really important to me. And it was really interesting to work on a novel with this in mind, or this feeling that I wanted to have some sort of fresh forms in there and kind of fresh ways of using language. And because I'd done that a lot with sort of really short stories or short prose poem kind of things. Mm-hmm. But to interject it in my novel was quite a task, and I had to figure, you know, I tried a million different things with languages or with these little conceits that I had to sort of make the whole book feel almost rhythmic in a way. And a lot of them didn't work, and I would scrap them. And I ended up sort of toward the end of the book, after I had really gotten the narrative and the trajectory of the book down, is when I really was able to go back in and sort of interject these kind of like little prose poem-y moments. Like there's this conceit that I use in the book where I do these portraits. I call them portraits it's portraits of the city or portraits of experiences, but they're broken down into sections of parts of the body. So it will be like the torso, and then I have a little description of whatever I'm talking about in regards to the torso part of the body, or an arm or a face. And I also was doing that specifically because Raoul, as an artist, is a portrait artist. He paints a lot of people, so I wanted to sort of get from a painter, a portrait artist point of view, what things would look and feel like. That was a long answer to that question, but I guess
fine.
I think that what energizes me about writing in general is creative use of language and form. Mm-hmm. And so it's exciting to me to hear that you picked up on that and felt like it was new and exciting to read.
Very much. And I kept looking forward to the cigarette. I'll suck, you know, it's like yeah. cigarette. Okay, here we go.
I just use that word to sort of delineate breaks in the prose, so that almost like someone would go outside and smoke a cigarette, and it's like a break of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would use that as sort of these this physical marker in the text of giving the reader that little break.
Some of our listeners might consider your childhood to have been somewhat non-traditional. You want to tell us about where you grew up and what that was like?
Yeah, so I grew up in Northern California, just outside of Santa Cruz. And I grew up in a communal living situation. So my parents, along with eight other young people at the time, they were in their late 20s, early 30s, and they all purchased this piece of land, a 10-acre piece of land, together. And at the time, I think it was like $5,000 each or something to buy this land. And it's a really gorgeous property. It's overlooking the Monterey Bay, and they built individual houses on it. And then there's one big house that they all share and where they have dinner every night. They still live there now. And so I grew up in this sort of really distinct place where I sort of had almost like I had three sets of parents and people who influenced adults who influenced me. And then I had these siblings that weren't actually my siblings, but who I grew up with. And I think it was a great way to grow up. It was one of the amazing things about having like kids in a place like that is that it was really sort of the property is sort of contained, so we could just be outside all the time and exploring. And there was always one or another adult watching us. And so I think probably where, I mean, as all kids, there was just so much room for invention and play and experimentation and imagination. And I think that's sort of where a lot of my quest for imagination came from.
Mm. It sounds like a heavenly childhood. It really does.
It was a pretty good one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Molly Prentice joins us. Her novel is Tuesday Nights in 1980. I read the New York Times every day. I'm kind of addicted to it. And mm-hmm. I read about the art auctions, and we see the names of some of these artists that you mention in your story back in 1980, and we see the prices that some of this artwork goes for. And one in particular that you mentioned a couple of times is Jeff Koons, who apparently at the time uh-huh. had the notorious vacuum cleaners that were sealed in plexiglass.
Yeah.
You mentioned that a couple of times. And me, uh-huh. I feel like an old fogey when I say this, but I look at that and I just go, you know, is that art? I mean, what? It's just, it boggles my mind to see the art world. And there's stuff that I consider to be truly art, and then there's other stuff where I just kind of go, I don't get it.
Yeah.
And we get a flavor of that in your story. So what's that?
I think that's a big question. And I think, I mean, it was before the time my book takes place in where that stuff was sort of first coming up. But I do think that in the early 80s, that moment right then was, there was that sort of like everything and anything could be art, and the money was following in all these weird ways. And it was just sort of an interesting time where, you had people like Andy Warhol or like Jeff Koons or any of them where commercialization was actually like one of the sort of points of their art making, which mm-hmm. I think is an interesting idea or concept, I guess. So I don't know. I guess I didn't really answer anything with that. But
well, I look at someone like Damien Hirst. Mm-hmm. Isn't he the one that puts the dead animals in plexiglass?
Yeah, I mean, the sharks and stuff.
This is just like, it's a beautiful animal, but what did you have creatively to do with this other than putting it inside this container? I mean, it defies my understanding, I guess.
Yep, I think, I mean, it does mine as well. I'm open to it. I mean, I'm open to considering anything art if I can hear about it, talk about it in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what you mean. I mean, I think a lot of those types of works are very elusive and almost they feel like they're purposefully so in this way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very intellectual argument, I guess, for like why they're considered art.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest on the program today is Molly Prentice. Her debut novel is Tuesday Nights in 1980. And her third character that she introduces in the story is a character named Lucy. And Lucy has moved to New York City, to her dream city from the small town of Ketchum, Idaho. I'm going to read you an excerpt about her arrival in New York and what that was like. She came in the middle of the summer, and we began here. Despite the ridiculous heat and the difficulty of the suitcases, the walk to Jamie's was thrilling. There was a feeling that a school bell had just been rung, and everyone had rushed out of their classes and into the streets, and they were now to partake in whatever the world could offer them. There were incredibly short shorts, and there was incredibly large hair. One woman's torso was entirely exposed, aside from one band of her unitard that covered each nipple. She also wore a large black hat. There was unique clothing, and coming soon, East Village Video, and Best Porn in Town, XXX. Everything, walls, telephone booths, sidewalks, was painted on or marked in unfamiliar, intriguing scribbles that said cryptic things like Destroy or Lovers Wanted. She passed a place called the Aztec Lounge where a sign read, Refreshing, Eclectic, Soothing Cocktails. Ancient Amulet Keeps Out Demons. This both frightened and excited her, and she wondered what demons lived here that would require an ancient amulet to keep out. Lucy wove among the new streets unnoticed. The feeling of it, of not being recognized or watched, made her giddy and terrified. She could do whatever she pleased. She could take any turn. She could write on a wall herself if she wanted. Who was there to see her besides all these people who didn't care? There was no Mick telling her to sweep the floors, and no mother asking when she would be home. She could answer an ad she found blowing in the wind. Everything awaited her. The building soared. Kids played in the streets in their underwear. She was arriving. This was her arrival. Jamie, who was standing on the corner in what looked to be lingerie, was smoking the longest and thinnest cigarette Lucy had ever seen. Though it was only 10 a.m., and she was still in her sleep clothes, Jamie's lips were already painted a bright red, the same red as the paper kiss. Lucy had lugged her suitcase what seemed like 100 blocks, and the sweat trickling from her armpits was making its way down to the waistband of her jeans, which faced with Jamie seemed highly unfashionable. Jamie was all legs and lipstick, wearing an intimidating musk perfume, and Lucy wondered if her trail of fate had failed her, if she should follow this woman at all. But then again, she did need a place, and a hotel would be expensive. She had only her mother's quarters, a book of checks linked to a new bank account she had started with the money she'd made at Mason and Mix, $1,214, which seemed like a lot until you began to calculate how long it would actually last. She smiled tentatively and followed smoking Jamie upstairs, watching her black skimpy chemise work its way up the stairs and up her thin thighs. The stairwell smelled of urine, paint, and cigarettes. The New York stairwell smell. Not the Idaho stairwell smell. Old wood, mud, pine. Then she thought, but Idaho doesn't even have stairwells. Had she ever been in a stairwell? This thrilled her. A new physicality. A new layout for her life. Hope you're in the market for a walk-up, Jamie called back to her. Lucy smiled. Walk-up? This was her new language. These stairs were her new portal. Welcome to Klein Deutschland, Jamie said breathlessly when they got upstairs to a dismal white-walled apartment furnished with nothing but an old orange couch whose material reminded Lucy of a clown suit. Thank you, Lucy said nervously, not understanding Jamie's reference, but not wanting to seem stupid by asking about it. Little Germany, Jamie clarified. This street used to be the German Broadway. The storefront downstairs used to be a cobbler. Now, of course, it's a porn shop. Personally, I like to imagine the Germans phasing into the new biz. Jamie laughed roughly as she inhaled on her cigarette. Lucy forced herself to laugh a little bit, too. She pulled her suitcase into the tiny room, closet size, with no closet of its own, looked up at the ceilings, which were, oddly, she thought, made of tin, indented with a flowery pattern. A crack ran from the central light fixture down to the bedroom's door, where it was dead-ended by a loose piece of finishing. The crack made Lucy feel nervous, and then, as she followed it down to the floor, where a glinting black bug scurried around the baseboard, she was pushed into full-blown panic. She looked to Jamie for some sort of explanation, but her new roommate was unfazed. "The Love Shack," Jamie said dryly. "Space for a bed, and hey, that's all you really need, right?" That's an excerpt from Tuesday Nights in 1980 by Molly Prentice. The Book Nook continues. We'll continue our conversation with Molly right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. We produce The Book Nook in the studios of WYSO. Every Saturday morning, you can hear it at 7 o'clock, and every Sunday morning at 10:30. And this morning, we're talking to Molly Prentice about her debut novel. It's called Tuesday Nights in 1980. In your story, James Bennett has this, I guess you would call it a gift, this synesthesia. Mm-hmm. And for him, there's a very interpersonal connection between art and people.
Mm-hmm.
There's something. He feels this powerful, overwhelming connection when he sees this particular picture with a person that posed for the picture. He sees that picture, and he's completely overcome. And it's also very powerful for him because I didn't realize that synesthesia was sort of a fluid thing. Is that true? Does it come and go, or is it, how does it work?
Well, so that's, I don't think it's normal that it comes and goes, but I read a bunch of these messages or sort of chat room boards online of people that have synesthesia. And I came across one or two that spoke to having lost this condition or, you know, like having it disappear, especially after a traumatic event in their life.
Mm.
So that was really interesting to me. And I was especially, I gravitated toward writing about it when I discovered that, because I imagined not only how intense it would be to have this different condition and to be able to see the world in this way, but then to have that removed or taken away from you, and then suddenly the way that you've always seen the world, no matter if it was different from everyone else and got you into some trouble before, like now you don't have that anymore. And what does that feel like to sort of face that empty space? And so I think, that really intrigued me about it. I think I'm intrigued with loss and how people cope with it or fill it. And I think that plays a role in all of these characters' trajectories throughout this book. I especially like to think about or end up thinking about what the loss of things that really define a person for themselves. So like all of these characters have these things that define them as humans or as creative individuals or in the world, the way they see themselves in the world. And I sort of sent them all through, I stole everything away from them that defined them.
Mm-hmm.
I hope this isn't giving anything. I don't think it's giving anything major away, but But then I just wanted to sort of play out like how each of them would try to find themselves again or try to find their place in the world again after they didn't have that thing that defined them for themselves.
Well, it's quite a debut for you, Molly. Molly Prentice joins us. Her book is Tuesday Nights in 1980. And I know we have a lot of listeners out there who are probably wondering, okay, it's her first novel. How did she get a book deal? What was the process? How did this happen?
It was very long. It was a very long process. It was, as most of these things are, part luck and part massive amounts of hard work and a really long amount of time. So I've been working on this book for 7 years, give or take, actually a little bit longer than that now. And I worked on it for, it was my graduate school thesis. And but then I sort of knew that it wasn't done yet or anything, so I wasn't about to shop it around at all when I was done with graduate school. But when I graduated, why I moved back to New York was that I got a fellowship at this place called the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, which is this amazing nonprofit artist sort of entity, which goes and takes over empty floors of downtown Wall Street buildings and converts them into artists and writer spaces for 9 months at a time. So I had the luck to be a part of this fellowship where there were 20 visual artists and 6 writers, and we had these spaces in these office buildings in Lower Manhattan. And it was there that we had these weekly meetings every week with different professionals in our field. So different novelists would come in and editors and agents. And we would meet with them. It actually happened to be on Tuesday nights. We would meet with them. And I met with one editor who took a liking to the pages that I had her read and offered me a couple names for agents that she thought I should query. And little did I know, because I knew nothing about sort of the business of getting a book deal at that time. They happened to be like the two most major agents in New York City. And so I blindly queried them and, you know, kind of stupidly, because they don't read anything that just a random person sends them. You have to have some sort of in to even get read. Mm-hmm. But then I realized after I queried them that that one of them was one of my old professor's agents. So I told him I had queried him, and he sent him a little note and let him know that I had submitted the pages. And so he didn't take me on that big time agent, but he said, I have this agent colleague who is fresh out the gate, and she's my age. And so she's young and hungry, and she might want to take a look at Molly's work. And so she ended up, liking the work and offering to read more of it. And she was like, send me the whole manuscript. But I didn't have the whole manuscript. So I basically spent another year or so even getting the manuscript together to send her. And even then she said, this isn't going to hack it. You need to work on this more, and gave me some guidelines. And then she didn't sign me until probably 2 years after I met her. And then she and I worked together for, I don't know, probably 2.5-3 more years, getting the manuscript in a position where she thought we should take it out to sell. So it was a lot of work to even get her on to sign with me. And then once we signed, we worked for many years together to get in a position to send it out into the world. And then once we sent it out into the world, it was great, and it sold overnight. So that was... that was exciting, but that came after a lot of drudging through the literary mud.
A lot of work. Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My guest has been Molly Prentice. Her novel, her debut, is Tuesday Nights in 1980. I'm going to close out the Book Nook today with one more excerpt from Molly's new novel. And this features her third character, the Argentine painter, Raul. A new New York had emerged since Engales entered the world of the squat, spinning around him like a fabulous tornado, sucking him up and into it. The squat became more than a physical space. It was an idea of movement, a group of people who traveled like a scent of tentacles around the city, sucking the air and life out of every place they landed. Engales danced to the B-52s at Studio 54, made out with models at Max's, bummed cocaine from a performance artist with a silver-painted body, crashed maximalist parties at minimalist lofts. He hung out hungover on velour couches in illegal event spaces in what was soon to be called Soho, but was then just the nameless hellhole where the streets went rebelliously against the grid. He shook hands with old men in sweat-ring polyester whose lawn chairs might never touch a lawn. He witnessed the quintessential fire hydrant sprains of the summer months when little children scream from the pressure of the water. He smoked cigarettes with women who weren't wearing shirts because why would they? Never went to bed before 4 a.m. because why would they? Never ventured above 14th Street because why would they? And generally vibrated with the artistic adrenaline that the gorgeous downtown grime produced. It was the grime that was glamorous, he came to realize. The importance of destruction and decay that sidelined gain and growth. The way the artists gravitated toward the most destitute of places and therefore gravitated to one another that made them all feel rich. In reality, they were mostly undiscovered and very poor. But somehow, being poor in New York was not dire or scary like it was back in Argentina, where the electricity would shut off for weeks or he and his sister might not have enough food. This new life, even after the newness had sunken in, seemed like a surreal and inconsequential portrayal of real life. It was almost like a painting of a life. He often felt as if he wasn't in his own body, as if things weren't actually happening to him. And if they did, they didn't count. Simultaneously, he felt everything more strongly. Joy, excitement, claustrophobia, anger, pleasure, inspiration. He was more inspired to make art here than he had been in his life. Where he had began painting as a way out of his real life, which had become almost impossible to endure, he now painted as a way into life. He wanted to go as deep as he could into life, all the way. He had never before felt any influence from any other artist, but here it was impossible not to. He wanted Keith Haring's lines, Clementi's expression, Warhol's bravado, Donald Sultan's shapes. He took a sketchbook with him everywhere and often found himself in the corners of galleries sketching something he'd been moved by. He took what he wanted and incorporated it into his own work. He morphed with the city's mood. He grabbed faces from the streets, stole hues from the spotlights. What emerged was a chaotic chorus, paintings that rang with the sounds of New York City, paintings that, despite their influences, felt and looked and sounded like nothing he'd ever felt or seen or heard. That's Raul, the Argentine exile painter living in New York City, discovering the joys of a city where he was actually born, but he'd only lived there as an infant, and he returns, escaping from Argentina. In the debut novel by Molly Prentice, it's called Tuesday Nights in 1980. And that was the Book Nook for today. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for the Book Nook. This past week, we marked another anniversary of a tragic event in Northern Ohio that took place on May 4th, 1970, when Ohio State National Guardsmen fired on a crowd of Kent State students. Four of them died. Tomorrow at 10:30, we'll be talking to Howard Means. His new book, 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence. He looks at the events that led up to the shooting, the climate in our country at the time, the anti-war demonstrations, President Nixon and Vice President Agnew speaking out against the anti-war protesters. It all came to a very tragic climax on May 4th, 1970, on the campus of Kent State. That's the Book Nook tomorrow morning at 10:30, right here on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.